So Hebrews 12 is wrapping up the book. Hebrews 12 and 13 are kind of his wrap-up chapters. And what he's done, what he's established in the first 11 chapters, is he's established the supremacy of what Jesus' ministry was, that Jesus is not just some prophet. He is God's only begotten Son. He is God incarnate, come down to minister to us, that his sacrifice is superior to any sacrifice that you could ever have, that by believing in what he did, by faith in what he did alone, you are cleansed from your sins and you are one with God. You are in a relationship with God that cannot be broken by anything. Neither height, nor depth, nor principality, nor any created thing can pluck you from his hand. You are one with God. And Hebrews 11 gave us a demonstration of people, even in the old covenant, who put their faith, who put their supreme faith in God, and they had a relationship with him. And his argument is from the lesser to the greater. If these people were able to have such a beautiful relationship with God and see his beauty and see him as the greatest joy, the greatest pleasure, the greatest treasure that you could ever have, how much more can Christians have who have seen the only begotten Son of God, who have received the gospel and love and follow him? So after that chapter, he begins Hebrews 12 like this. He says, therefore, because of all those things I just mentioned, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. And then he'll go on from there. So I like this passage because what he's done is he's using a metaphor. He's saying that the Christian life is like a marathon. That's what he's saying. I don't know. How many of you guys run long distance ever? Run long distance? Hike? Something? Play video games for marathon sessions? You know, like something? Yeah? No? Okay. A couple of you guys. So a marathon, the reason why he's comparing it to a marathon is, unfortunately, in the Christian church, when we listen to sermons and stuff like that, we tend to think that the Christian life is kind of like a sprint, you know, where it's like you have a trial, you have a struggle, and you just get through it, you know, and it's like a sprint. You do like one little exertion of effort, and then it's over, you know, and then you're on easy street, and you just kind of cruise for the rest of the Christian life. And if you ever listen to someone's testimony, you definitely get that idea, where they're like, you know, back in 1994, I was this and I was that, and I was doing drugs and I was shooting heroin and I was all crazy. And then I gave my life to Jesus Christ in 1996, and that's the end, you know. And everyone's like, woo, you know. And then the obvious question is, what has God done in your life in the last 20 years? You know, is that it? Is that the end? And if we're honest, any Christian would be, if they were being honest with you, would say, no, that's not the end. Getting saved is the beginning of the race. So if you think about it in line of a marathon or like some sort of a relay race, what he's saying is when you get saved is when the baton gets into your hand and now you start running. Now the exertion begins. That's what he's saying. He's saying running the Christian life is not easy. It's certainly not easy, and a lot of the times it certainly isn't fun. And it's not about so much what we're running away from than what we're running toward. And here's what I mean. Notice what he says. He says, let us lay aside every weight, which I'll talk about in a second, and the sin which so easily ensnares us. So he's saying, let's get rid of sin. Let's run away from sin. And most pastors, they just focus on the idea of running away from sin. And the way they do that is they just really focus in on how evil sin is. And they'll be like, Don't commit sexual sin. Don't have sex before marriage because you're going to get STD and you're going to unplanned pregnancy and this and that. And don't view pornography because this is going to happen to you. And don't drink because it's going to kill your liver and it's going to ruin your family. And they go into all these negatives, right? All these negatives about sin and regarding sin. And you're like, great, I know what to run away from. But they never talk about what to run toward. Now, it surprised you in the Christian New Testament, there's really not much passages on the negativity of sin. They're there, but they're very rare. They're almost non-existent. You'll barely find them. Because the importance of the New Testament is not how wicked sin is. The importance of the New Testament is how beautiful Jesus is. That's the importance of the New Testament. And the way that you live your life directly correlates to how you see Jesus. If you see Jesus the way I saw Jesus when I was your guys' age, as being kind of a bummer, right? I believed in him, but I didn't love him. I didn't think he was cool. I just thought, like, well, he exists, he's real, and he's going to judge me one day, so I better, you know, better ship up and shape up and follow the Lord, because that's what he's going to do. He's got a list, right? And he's going to check it twice. Going to find out he's not even nice. He's going to jack me up if I don't do right. So I need to really follow him. I need to really obey him. And that was my perspective of God when I was your guys' age. And so because of that, I was like, man, I got to get rid of this sin in my life, because if I don't get rid of pornography, I'm going to have a terrible marriage and my life's going to be ruined. And, you know, God is angry with me. He's upset with me and I need to get free. And that was my picture. That was my perspective of God. But I never, ever, ever thought of God as being pleasurable. That never even entered my mind that God was a pleasurable God. But if you notice, this whole chapter, it says the Christian life is like running a marathon. And when you're running a marathon, you're not running away from anything, right? A marathon's not about running away from the starting line. The marathon is about running toward the finish line, right? That's a marathon. If all a marathon was about was just getting away from the starting line, then you could give up at any moment. You could be like, well, I made it away from the starting line, so I'm good. And so many Christians live their life that way, where they start out the Christian race and they're like, well, I'm not doing drugs and I'm not drinking anymore. Great. And then they just kind of settle down. And like, I'm done. And that is certainly not the perspective of the Christian life. This is the way that Paul put it in Philippians 3. So Paul, one of the greatest evangelists to ever live, and this is what he wrote toward the end of his life. He says, Philippians 3, verse 12, he says, not that I have attained, nor am I perfect. Right? If any of you guys think that you could become perfect in the Christian life, Paul would disagree with you. If Paul, at the end of his life, said he's not perfect, I don't think I got a shot, you know? I don't think I have a chance in hell to ever become perfect this side of heaven. If Paul himself says, I'm not perfect. He says, neither have I attained, nor have I been perfected, but this I do, I press on that I may lay hold of that for which Christ has laid hold of me. Brethren, I do not count myself to have attained, but this I do, not looking behind, I look ahead unto Jesus, who is the hope of my call. That's what he says. It's Philippians 3, verse 12 through 14. Very important section. So Paul also views it as a marathon type race. And Paul says it is about seeing your prize, not about seeing what's behind you. That's not what it's about. That's not what running the race is about. So I could certainly give you guys sermons about why sin is bad. And if you don't believe that sin is bad, then you need to get that sermon, right? You need to have a sermon that explains why sin is bad. But more important than that, more important than anything else, we need to have sermons that teach us why Jesus is so good. Why Jesus is so good. Because that is what's going to keep you guys running, even when sin is not a problem, even when sin is not capturing you or leading you astray. If you don't have this perspective, what you're going to live a Christian life that's on a roller coaster. You're going to have a moment of desperation where you realize that sin is just destroying your life and you cry out to God. You're like, God, help me, save me. And then God's going to save you from that sin. You're going to get onto a high point. You're like, this is great. And then you're going to totally forget God. You're going to slowly slip right back into your sin. And then you're going to cry out to God again. You're going to be delivered. And then you're going to go down and you're going to go up. There's a great psalm if you want to read it, Psalm 107, that totally details this, what it's like. And it's a long psalm, but it's an important one to read, because that is the exact type of relationship with God that most Christians have, where they're on a constant roller coaster. How do you get off the roller coaster? Hebrews 12 tells us. It's not about running from sin. It is about running toward Jesus. So absolutely we need to throw off the sin in our lives. Absolutely we need to get away from the sin that's in our lives. But another important thing, why Jesus has to be the treasure that we're running after, is because if any of you guys have tried to stop sinning, you'll realize that fear is an inadequate motivator. It doesn't matter how afraid you are of sin, it's not going to keep you from sinning. And every single one of us understands that, right? In your life, if your parents were tell you, like, hey, you know what? Don't touch this in the house, right? This in the house, this is my special portrait, whatever. I don't know. Your parents have something precious in their house that they told you as a kid not to touch. I had a bunch of stuff like that in my house. Don't touch this, you know, because I broke things. Don't touch this. Don't ever, you know, put your finger on it. And I'm like, as a kid, I'm like, okay. But in my mind, I didn't even care. I was like, I'll take the spanking, you know, and I like took it off and I like break it. And I didn't care because the allure of that object was just more important to me than the fear of the punishment. And when you grow up, then you start driving your car and there are traffic laws. And you'll break them all the time because you're like, you know, there's no cops here. You know, like I pay attention. I've gotten like 6 speeding tickets since I've started driving. You know, like I've flipped a car and gotten in a couple of accidents. But anyway, you know, that's not important. That's not what we're talking about today. The important thing is that even though I have a fear of what could go wrong, my desire to speed, my desire to break the traffic logs is greater than my fear for speeding. There is no such thing as a fear that is strong enough to stop you guys from sinning. If it was, all I would have to do, I go to the Salvation Army every week and talk to the men there. All I would have to do to talk to those men is be like, don't stop sinning, you know, it's going to ruin your life. Now, if you go to, you guys know what the Salvation Army is, right? You see them ringing the bells now. They're in front of every store, right, bugging you, right, for money and all that. It's a great ministry. And this is what they do. They bring in homeless people, people who are completely addicted to alcohol, completely addicted to drugs, and it's ruining their lives, and they have no way of getting clean. They have no way of getting out. They have no money coming in. They feed them, they clothe them, they teach them the gospel, and they train them how to get a job, how to interview, how to stop being homeless in a 6-month course. And it's free. They give them food, they give them clothes, they give them a place to stay, and they teach them how to do these things, how to interview, how to get a job. And every single one of the men in that room knows what their sin is doing to them. I don't have to explain it to them. Their sin has already taken away their family, it's already taken away their sanity, it's already taken away their jobs, and now they're homeless on the street. What more could motivate someone like that? When you go to someone who's lost their family, home, everything, they're living on the street, they have no food, and all they have is their drug, they know pretty well how severe their sin problem is. But it's not strong enough to make you stop. There is no such thing as a fear that is stronger than your sin inclination. It doesn't exist. Now, a lot of us live our lives, we've grown up in the church, and we have this fearfulness in our lives. If you struggle with fearfulness, by the way, it's because you've been raised this way. You've been raised to fear sin as opposed to adore Jesus. And that's a problem. That's never going to serve you well. One of the best examples I could give you guys is I had a friend in the Marine Corps. His name was Christopher Larson. He's a great guy. He just got married last month. And he struggled with a lot of things. Alcohol, ecstasy, cocaine. I don't know if he ever did meth, but he definitely did a lot of pot. He had a lot of problems in his life. And even though he had all these negative consequences happening to him, he had lost jobs, he had lost his family, he was in the Marine Corps because he really had nothing at all back at home. And in the Marine Corps, he was in danger of losing his job in the Marine Corps because the Marine Corps has a zero tolerance policy when it comes to drugs. If you get caught with drugs in your system, you're out, you're done. You get a dishonorable discharge, which is not a great thing to have on your resume, and you get thrown out. But even though he had all this fear accompanying him for not doing drugs, it wasn't enough to make him stop. But then Larson realized that he had had a kid with this girl before he went into the Marines, and they were both drug users, and so she took custody of their daughter, and she left and went, and she was actually living in Tucson, surprisingly. And then he went into the Marine Corps. And he learned, while he was over in the Marines with me, he learned that the CPS had come into their house and they had found his ex-girlfriend OD'd on the ground, and they found his daughter playing with a heroin needle. And so obviously the CPS took her away. And they called him and told him, like, hey, man, if you don't clean up your act and you don't take custody of this girl, she goes into the system. That's what's going to happen to her. Now, the fear of losing his job wasn't enough to make him stop. But the love of his daughter was enough. Fear is not an adequate motivator, but love certainly is. If you have an adequate enough love, if you have a strong enough love, it is absolutely powerful enough to change your life. And that's just a human love. That's just the love of a dad to his daughter was strong enough to break his bonds of sin. A lot of men, by the way, the love that they have for their kids isn't strong enough to do that. But even so, that love, that human love that he had for his daughter was strong enough to break his bonds of sin. And I don't know if you guys know this, but getting free from things like ecstasy and heroin and stuff like that, that is not easy. That is not an easy thing to do. There is a biological impact that those things have in your life. Getting free from those things, getting clean from those types of substances is very, very, very hard to do. But the love that he had for his daughter was strong enough to do it. Now, he later was a Christian at that time, but he was definitely backslidden. And after that, he ended up giving his life back to God, and it ended up changing his life. But my point to you guys is, if a human love is strong enough to do that, how much more is a divine love powerful enough to set you free from sin? How much greater is the love of God's only Son, who loved you enough to actually crucify himself for you, going to be to deliver you from whatever you struggle with? But you will absolutely never get free from your sin if all you think about are the consequences. You will never get free from your sin if all you can think about are the consequences. You must think about the reward. That's why he says, looking unto Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. That's what the race, that's what the Christian life is about. It's about running toward Jesus. That is what we are trying to do. And the more we see him, the more that we see his beauty, the more that we see his loveliness, his satisfaction, his joy, his pleasure, the more you see these things, the more you will be set free from your sin. But the one doesn't happen without the other. Meaning you cannot be set free from your sin unless you have tasted and seen that God is good. And you are continuously doing it daily. The race in Christianity is a race for joy. Man, we are running toward joy. We are running towards pleasure. And in order to kind of understand why this is so difficult for us, let me put it in human terms of why this is so hard for us to do before God. Let's say the Bible equates sin a lot of times to cheating on God. That's what it equates it to. Now imagine if I cheated on my wife, and she catches me. I go home, and she's like, you cheated on me. What happened? And I was like, you know what happened? You weren't a good enough wife. You weren't giving me enough pleasure. If you give me more pleasure, I'll never do it again. You know, that is essentially what I'm telling you guys to say to God. Now what does that sound like? When I say it to a human being, does that sound selfish? Sounds a little selfish, right? Sounds a little misguided. Sounds a little foolish. Sounds a little jerky. You know, like there's a lot of problems with that. Now, let me explain why it's wrong to say that to a human being, but it is absolutely right to say that to God. Number one, a human being's forgiveness is imperfect. When I sin against my wife, even if she forgives me, there's going to be a level of pain and resentment and bitterness that's welling up inside of her heart that's going to take a long time to heal and move over. God isn't like that. Because of what Jesus Christ did for you guys on the cross, when you come before God, his forgiveness is instantaneous. Before you even ask for forgiveness, he has already given it to you. And when he says he forgives you, he means all the pain, all the agony that you put him through is immediately forgotten because of what Jesus Christ did for you. Human beings aren't like that. The second thing that's important to understand, we understand this on a human level to a certain degree, but to a godly degree, we don't understand this. God most delights in being delighted in. That is his greatest joy. God most delights in being delighted in. Now, in a human perspective, like I said, we understand that Christmas is coming up. Now, for those of you guys who are kids, you're not going to understand this as well, but some of you are growing up and you're old enough to buy presents for people. There is a real joy in giving someone a good gift, isn't there? When they open the gift and they're like, oh my gosh, this is exactly what I wanted. There is a delight. There is an intense pleasure in being delighted in. You guys understand that? Right? There's a video that Caleb showed me a little bit ago that just makes me laugh, where it's like two friends opening presents, and one of them, he gets the gift, and before he opens it, he's like, hey, you know what I hate? Before I open this, you know what I really hate? He's like, what? He's like, Scorpion King 2, Rise of a King. I really hate that, specifically on Blu-ray. You know, and he's like, and you see his friend's face just like drop, and yeah, he's like, all right, let me open this, and he opens it up, and of course, it's Scorpion King 2. And he's like, Scorpion King 2. Specifically on Blu-ray. He just like throws it in space and walks away. It's a funny video because there's nothing worse than trying to serve somebody and have them throw it back in your face, right? To not appreciate what you're doing for them. There's nothing worse than that. But there's nothing better than actually filling someone's needs, to actually delight someone. That's how God is like. We get that from being made in the image and likeness of God. Nothing hurts God more than you not being satisfied in Him. God could care less if you don't sin today if you do not delight in Him. The Christian who doesn't sin but isn't happy with God is useless. It is not pleasing at all to God. The Christian that doesn't sin because he delights in God is very pleasing to the Lord. So when you're asking God, after I sin, to say, God, I need more of your pleasure, I need more of your joy, because I'm not satisfied enough in you, and that's why I keep going to these things, you're not being selfish. You are asking God to do the thing that He most delights in doing. You are asking Him, God, I want to delight in you. I want to glorify you. I want people to see your light shining from my life, and the only way to do that is to be satisfied in you. That's what we're praying. That's what we're asking God to do. That's what delivers you from sin. Now let's talk about the weight. So sin's easy, right? We're all like, okay, obviously I need to throw off sin of my life. What's the weight? What's he talking about there? So when you're running a marathon, it's not a good idea to run a marathon in combat boots, right? You don't want to run a marathon with a backpack full of weight. You know, it's something I learned in the Marine Corps. Anything weighs a lot after a certain amount of time, right? They taught us that in boot camp in ways that you wouldn't believe. They would be like, dude, air weighs a lot after time. We're like, nah. And they're like, okay, lift the air. And so like you have to do this for hours, and you're like, after like 30 minutes of doing this, you're like, this is so heavy, you know, like I can't do it anymore. Like anything is heavy after a certain amount of time. And they would take us on hikes, and these hikes would last 20 miles. They would last 30 miles. And you realize even a pack that weighs 2 pounds becomes like death to you after mile 10, after mile 15. You're like, oh my gosh, this is so heavy. You know, like you can't do it. Then, you know, we were actually hiking with 100-pound packs, so that was really hell. But, you know, you have to deal with these things, and you realize that if you have to go a long distance, you don't want anything that's going to slow you down. What this means to most Christians, is the wrong question to ask is it a sin? Is it really wrong if I do dot, dot, dot? Is that really, you know, does that really offend God? Is that really bad if I do this? That is the absolute wrong question to ask. The question that we need to ask is, does it help me run? Does this help me? Does this move me in a way that is pleasing to God? Is this beneficial to me? Is a question that we should be asking. Asking, is this illegal, is a loser question to ask. If someone was in the Olympics and they go up to the ref and they say, is it illegal for me to run this race with a bag on my back? The ref would look at them and be like, it's not illegal, but it's freaking stupid. You know, you could do it if you want, but you're going to lose. That is someone who's not concerned with the prize. That is someone who doesn't understand the glory that he's running after. You guys understand that? So a Christian, if you guys come up to me and say, is it wrong to dot, dot, dot? That's not a good question. This is not a good question. It shows that you do not understand what you're running after. It shows that you do not understand the joy of God. The correct question is, does this help me? Is this beneficial for me? Does this activity really make me more Christ-like or not? That is the question that we always should be asking ourselves. So because of that, thinking about weight in our life is actually really easy. We start looking in our lives, and there are things in your life that aren't sinful, but they aren't helpful either. It's not a sin, right? Let me give you guys an example. I loved video games. I used to play it all the time. Video games are not sinful. So Those of you guys who are worried right now, you're kind of clenching up. Oh, no, he's going to say video games. No, video games are not sinful. You guys can play video games. There's nothing wrong with video games. But for me, video games became a weight. They became a weight. They became a hindrance to my pursuit of God. Right? For me, they became that. I'm not saying for everybody, but for me, that was what they were in my life. So I had to throw them off. Now, when I threw them off, it wasn't like, oh, I got to do this because God told me to. It was like, dude, I want to pursue. Jesus is so much better than that, that I gladly throw it off so that I can better pursue him. That's what this looks like. If there's any amount of like, oh, I don't want to, then you're not doing it for your prize. You're doing it because you feel guilty. And that's not honoring to God. That's not glorifying to God. So a Christian needs to always be thinking in their head, what are the things in my life that are sin that I need to throw off? And why am I not seeing Jesus as high and lifted up as he needs to be in my life? And the other question I'm asking is, what are the weights in my life? What are the, and weights could be anything. It could be relationships. Could be any of the hobbies that you like to do. And some of the hobbies, like I said, you could do them and they don't bother you. But some hobbies that you do, you might be like, you know, this kind of puts me in a mood. You know, this kind of like draws me away from God when I do this. You know, or this person, man, whenever I hang out with them, they just bring me down. You know, like I start acting. I realize that with a lot of my friends. I was like, man, I could be just like praising God. And then I go hang out with this guy. And all of a sudden I'm like, man, everything sucks. You know, he's just like the personality just drags you down. You're like, man, I need to. It's not that I cut those people off. I'm like, I can't hang out with you anymore because I'm in love with Jesus. You know, I was just like, I had to really take a step back from those relationships, though. I'd be like, man, I can't be as close to you as I once was because you bring me down. And I need to pursue God better, right? So that's the idea of running the race. And what he says, when he says looking unto Jesus, it's not just because he is the author and finisher of our faith. That is the major reason he gives, because Jesus is beautiful and he is all satisfying. He is more pleasurable than anything on this earth. That is the contention of the Bible. Jesus is more pleasurable than anything you can do. Any sin, any career, any person. He is better. That is what the Bible says. However, that is not the only reason why we look unto Jesus. We also look unto Jesus because he is our ultimate example. Anything you have to give up is nothing compared to what Jesus had to give up. So me having to give up sin and all these things, that's a sacrifice, it is. But it is nothing compared to the infinite God of the universe, who is timeless and spaceless, giving up his very image of immortality and becoming mortal. It is nothing compared to an immortal being engaging in death. That is another reason why the crucifixion of Jesus is greater than any other death that could ever happen in history. See, if I give my life for my wife, if I say, hey, I would take a bullet for her, and I would absolutely die for my spouse because I love her that much. But guess what? If I die for my spouse or not, one day I'm going to die. Does that make sense? So while the sacrifice is cool, it's not that cool. It's much different to take someone who would otherwise never die and have them die for you. That's what Jesus did. He took something upon himself that he didn't need to take upon himself. He died. And it says that Jesus, just like us, he did it for a prize. And this is cool when you really understand this. What is the prize? The prize is you. It's you. It's me. It's the church. It's the body. That's what Christ did it for. He looked at you and he looked at me and he said, you are enough of a treasure for me to sacrifice all things. And the more that we understand just how much Jesus loves us and cares for us, the more we let that fill our hearts, the more satisfied we could become in him. In Ephesians chapter 1, this is what Paul prays for the people of Ephesus. This is one of his... He only prays for them twice in this book, and both prayers are about the same. And they're both really cool. This is one of the prayers he prays. Ephesians 1, verse 18. That the eyes of your understanding being enlightened, that you may know what is the hope of his calling, God's calling, and what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints. What is he praying? That you would know just how precious you are in the eyes of God. Right? That's what I was missing out on when I was your guys' age. I did not think I was pleasing in the eyes of God. I thought that I was kind of just tolerated in the eyes of God. He's like, well, you know, I guess you prayed the prayer, so I guess you're in. But you better ship up. You know, that's kind of the mentality I got towards God. I never had this mentality towards God that he was so unbelievably loving me that he was willing to sacrifice everything for my sake. That I'm not someone who's tolerated. I'm someone who's sought after. That Jesus, when he goes after you, he goes after you like a treasure. Like he's pursuing a treasure in his life. He doesn't go after you like, he's not passive. He's not standing up in heaven saying, hey, you make it to me. He is a God who pursues us. Right? That's the mentality of God I need to have in my mind. That God is so worth it. He is so worth the effort because he was willing to do this for me first. Right? 1 John 4 says this, we love him because he first loved us. That's the message of the gospel. And then he also mentions how Jesus endured a lot of hostility. And I like verse 3, for he says, for consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. It's really easy in the Christian life to become weary and discouraged. Because what we think is, once again, we think that the Christian life is like a sprint. We think that, man, I'm going to stand up against this sin, and then I'm never going to struggle again. And that is not how it looks. You stand up against your sin, and a lot of times the sin gets more intense, and the temptation becomes harder to resist. Right? That's what usually happens. So we need to understand in our lives that when we're abstaining from sin, don't expect it to be easy. It's going to be incredibly difficult. But the way that we don't become weary is we realize exactly what our prize is and exactly what Jesus did for us. Now, this next part is going to be about discipline. So this is kind of like practically how it's going to look. This is going to be verse 5. He says, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you actually read the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 3, verse 11 through 12, which he's quoting from, it actually says, he chastens every son in whom he delights. In whom he delights. And just keep that in mind as we keep going. Verse 7, if you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have the human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed, for a few days, chastened as us as it seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening seems joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. So, if you guys remember, the people that the writer of Hebrews is writing to, the type of discipline, and I put that in quotations, that they were enduring was intense persecution and suffering. And I'll talk about that last. If I forget, someone remind me. But I will talk about that last. What I want to focus on is immediately what he's talking about is he's talking about fighting sin, and then he talks about a type of discipline that happens to us as a result of sinning. So what is this? What discipline is he talking about? Well, when you look through the Old Testament and the New Testament, God judges sin in a very specific way. A lot of us think that God would judge sin in a non-specific way, right? Like when I was growing up and I first started stepping out of line, I honestly thought that God was going to do something really hardcore to me. I started stepping out of line. I was like, oh my gosh, like now that God's going to give me like, you know, strep throat or something like that, or he's going to like a lightning bolt's going to hit me, or, you know, my parents are going to find out, or, you know, I thought these like hardcore, you know, punishments would happen to me, and none of them ever did. So I was like, oh, I guess God doesn't punish sin. But if I actually were to have read the Old Testament, I would have realized how God punishes sin. You know how God punishes sin? He lets you do what you want to do. It'd be like this. There are two ways to punish a child who wants to put his hand in fire, right? If you see a little, you know, snot-nosed kid, and he's always trying to put his finger inside the candle because it looks pretty, you know, as a parent, you have one of two ways to punish that kid. You could either, A, you could pull that kid aside and say, no, and slap his hand. Say, don't do that. You know, that's one way to do it. Or you can let them burn themselves. Those are the two ways to punish sin. Guess which kind of parent God is? He's the kind of parent that lets you burn yourself. That's what he does. He explains to you, don't get me wrong, he explains to you why you shouldn't put your finger in the candle. So he'll be like, hey, you know, if you do that, you're going to get burned. You know, it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt a lot. Don't do it. So he'll do that. But if you keep doing it, he'll be like, go for it. He's the parent that would actually sit back and be like, hey, why don't you do it? Put your finger, see what happens. It's going to be awesome. You know, he'll kind of encourage you in a second. And you're like, that doesn't sound like God. Oh, really? You remember the story of the prodigal son? The prodigal son wanted to go and sin, right? What does the father do? He not only says, okay, but he gives him money to do it. So the son's like, dude, I want to go live in the city. It's going to be fun. I'm going to sin it up. The father tells him at first no, but then after he insists, he goes, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to buy you a plane ticket there, you know? And I'm going to give you money to spend over there. And you're like, oh my gosh, it seems like he's approving of the sin. No, this is how God judges sin. This is what he does. If you want it so bad, God will let you do it. And this is always the better parenting. You see, if my son wants to put his finger inside the candle and I pull him away and I keep doing that, eventually what's going to happen in his heart is he's going to grow resentful towards me. Why? Because he's like, I want to put my finger in this candle and my dad won't let me. Because he's a jerk. And that candle's awesome. And he knows how good it is. You know, and he wants to keep it to himself. You know, so he's just telling me no, but he's not letting me. Right? And I would grow resentful. If God did that to us, we would grow resentful of him. Be like, I want to sin this way, but God's telling me no, and that's not right, you know, and you'd become rebellious, and you would be angry with God. But because God judges you this way, the only person you have to blame is yourself. God told you not to do it, you did it anyway, and now your life is suffering consequences. What Christians learn as we grow and as we mature, what discipline teaches us, is it teaches us something called consequences. The decisions in your life are going to have consequences. That's what happens. Doesn't mean there's not forgiveness, but it means that there are consequences. You see, if once again, going back to the story of the kid and the candle, if the son actually puts his finger in the candle and burns himself, that burning doesn't show that the father doesn't like the son. Does that make sense? The fact that he got burned doesn't mean that the father's looking at the son like, I hate you now. And good, I'm glad you got burned. You know, that's not what we're talking about. The father can then come beside the son and be like, this is why I told you not to do that. I love you and I care for you and I told you not to do it because I loved you. And now you know never to do that again. And that's what God does with us. So when we're suffering consequences of sin, never for one second believe that it's because God is against you. That's what Hebrews is saying. The reason why you're suffering for sinning is because it's because God loves you. It's because he cherishes you. If he didn't cherish you, if he didn't love you, then he wouldn't discipline you. Right? If I didn't give a crap about my kid, I wouldn't discipline him because disciplining him takes too much work. They would go, they would run, they would do their own thing. I'd be like, whatever, you know, it's not my responsibility. Let them be how they're going to be. And they would grow up and they would be completely unprepared for the world. See, it doesn't take a loving parent to not discipline their children. Any parent who doesn't care about their kids could do that. It takes a loving parent to discipline their children. It's difficult for God to see his children in pain. But he loves us enough to allow that pain to occur. So if consequences start happening in your life as a result of sinning, don't think that it's God against you. It's God for you. Now, what happens if you think it is God against you? There's a difference between discipline and justice. My dad disciplines me. The government judges me. The government doesn't discipline me. When I get pulled over by a cop, he doesn't say, this hurts me more than it hurts you. You know, and he writes the ticket and he's like, I'm so sorry, but if I don't do this, you won't learn from your mistake. And, you know, that's not what the cop says. He just says, hey, take care of this. And then he drives away. That's justice. Justice is just giving you what you deserve. You broke the law. This is what you deserve. The end, right? And when you do that, when you go through justice, you're just like, okay, well, that sucked, but I'm going to take it on the chin. I'm going to move on, and that's the end. Discipline is different. Discipline is suffering consequences from a wrong action and learning from it. That's what discipline is. When God corrects you, when he judges you, he's not judging you as a judge. He's judging you as a father. And the difference is huge. If you think that the consequences happening to you are justice, then you look at it and say, A, God is against me, and B, I just need to take this on the chin and move on. But if you understand it's a discipline, you will instead say, God is for me, and I'm supposed to learn something from this. God, what are you trying to teach me through this suffering? What are you trying to teach me through this pain that I don't do it again? That's why he says at the end, he says, now the chastening doesn't seem joyful for the present, but painful. You're not supposed to enjoy it. Right? I've never suffered consequences for sinning and be like, man, this is awesome. You know, it sucks. It's terrible. It's horrible. And guess what? Even after you learn your lesson, the consequences will continue depending on the severity of how you sinned. David is a great example. David committed a very intense sin. He had sex with a married woman and killed her husband, and he covered it up for a year and a half. That's an intense sin. God forgives him immediately when David asks for it. But what are the consequences? His son dies, and his children end up fighting each other for the rest of his life and even after his death. That is the legacy of David because of his sin. Those are some steep consequences. But it doesn't mean that God didn't forgive him and love him. No chastening seems pleasurable, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward, after the punishment, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. That word trained is the Greek word gymnasio. Guess what word we get from that? Gymnasium. Right? He's saying being trained, being disciplined is like working out. Now, I do like exercising, but here's the thing. I have never gone to the gym and worked out, and after I, you know, pushed myself to the limit and really worked out, did a good workout, I've never felt good afterwards. I've never been like, that was amazing. I feel amazing. You know, I feel stronger than when I went in. No, you're going to feel, if you did it right, you're going to feel weaker than when you went in. And if you didn't know about how, you know, physiology works and how your muscles grow, you would leave the gym being like, the gym hurts me. I'm never going back. You know, it's just out to get me, you know, and I feel sore now and it hates me, you know, and I wouldn't understand what's going on. But if I understand the purpose of the gym, I will go back and I will endure suffering because of what it produces. You guys understand that? The chastening of God is the same way. You're not going to feel good when God chastens you. But it's not there to destroy you. It's there to make you better. That's the purpose. Now, I said that another thing that I wanted to mention is the type of suffering that they were going through. They were going through intense amounts of suffering and pain. Here's the thing. Any suffering that you go through can be used as discipline for God, but that is an insufficient answer in and of itself. This is what I mean. 2 years ago, I'll use this as an example. 2 years ago, one of the members here lost their son. He died. He was very young. If I went to that funeral, which I did, I went to their funeral. If I went to the funeral and I talked to them and I said, hey, I know your son is dead, but this is God disciplining you. That is an insufficient, insensitive, really stupid answer that's not going to help anyone. If you lose something like that, saying this is discipline would mean, first of all, the reason why this happened is because you did something wrong, which is not true. And second of all, it means that the only reason why it happened is so you could learn something from it, which is also not true. God can certainly, and God has, by the way, the family still goes here and they're awesome, they're growing in God. God used that to help them in their walk with him, but that was not the only reason for it. If that was the only reason for it, then God is very cruel. God is not loving if that was the only reason for it. We will never know the entire reason of why God allowed that to happen until we get to heaven. But I guarantee you there was more reason than just he wanted them to be better. There are hundreds, thousands, maybe even millions of reasons of why God allowed things like that to happen. Our greatest example of that is Joseph. Joseph was abused by his brothers. He was abused by them. They threw him in a pit. They stripped him naked. They sold him into slavery. Some of you may look at your lives and say, I think I was abused by my family. I guarantee you, you weren't abused that much. How do I know? Because you're sitting in this room and you're not in slavery right now, right? They sold him into slavery. They allowed him to be abused his entire life. But because that happened, Joseph ended up becoming the ruler of Egypt and he ended up saving the entire world, including his family. So even though what they did was wicked and wrong, God had a reason for allowing it to happen. He had a lot of reasons for allowing it to happen. Even to this day, the thing that Joseph went through still inspires and helps Christians thousands of years later. You will never know the full extent to how much God is going to use your suffering, but everything you go through has multiple purposes. One of the purposes, one, and it could be the smallest one, one of the purposes is to train you. Every single thing that you go through can be used by God to discipline you, to make you a better Christian, if you see it the correct way. But saying that it is a discipline in and of itself is an insufficient answer, and that's why the writer of Hebrews doesn't make it the only reason. Okay, that's really important to understand. Now, I'm not going to go through the rest of the chapter. Some things that I do want to mention before we move on. The rest of it, by the way, I encourage you guys to read it on your own time. It just kind of goes over a lot of the stuff that he's already said about the difference that we have between the old and the new covenant. That we don't have the old covenant where we're terrified of God, but we have the new covenant where we're able to embrace and trust and follow God, even in suffering. And those, it's really cool sections, but I don't have time to go over it. One thing that I do want to mention, though, is it says in verse 10, talking about fathers, it says, "For they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit." Other translations, I think, render that a little bit better. But if you actually read it in the Greek, what that phrase really means is it means that all parents, when they disciplined you, they did the best they knew what to do. I mean, they were trying to help you the best they were. Now, some of us have good parents and some of us have really crappy parents. That's just the truth. But even those of us who have bad parents, those bad parents are still doing the best with what they have. They may just not know what the best is to do. They're just bad parents in a lot of ways. My dad's dad, I think, is a good example. My grandpa abandoned my dad when he was a little kid and ran away. And he's never told me this directly, but I do believe that this verse has helped my dad forgive his dad. When my grandpa was dying of Parkinson's about 10 years ago, my dad flew over to Minnesota, and he prayed for him, stayed with him for days, and actually led him to saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. Now, for my dad to forgive him so completely, something would have had to happen in his heart. And I think one of the things that happened in his heart is he realized, my dad did a lot of crappy things to me, and he hurt me. But honestly, that's all he knew how to do. Like, he was just a bad person. That's all he knew how to do. He was just not a good person. He wasn't saved. He didn't know God. And that was one of the things that enabled my dad to forgive his father. And that's important. No matter how good an example you have as a dad, every single one of our fathers is not perfect. And as you grow up and you learn how to love your parents correctly, one of the things you need to learn how to do is realize they did the best with what they had. They weren't perfect. They failed in a lot of ways. My parents failed in a lot of ways, but they did the best with what they had, and I'm thankful to them for what they gave me. Right? That needs to be understood in the way that you treat your parents, even if your parents were abusive to you. Right? God still calls us to forgive them. Right? And the way that you forgive them is you understand that they did the best with what they had. If they were saved, I mean, think about it. If they really knew Jesus, and they were saved, and they loved him, and they had the pleasure of God, and they knew how glorious God was, would they have abused you? No. It's because they abused you out of a lack in their own life. They abused you out of something that was missing in their own life. So part of your forgiveness is going to be understanding that. Once again, that is an insufficient answer. There's more to it than that. But this is all that the book of Hebrews is letting us know. He's just letting us know one piece of it, of how to love and forgive even bad parents. And he says more than that, if they did what seemed best to them, how much more should you submit to your Father in heaven who knows what's best for you and allows you to go through exactly what you need to go through so that you'll grow in him. That's what he's talking about. Ultimately, this is all about seeing the beauty of Jesus in all circumstances and submitting to him in discipline and in growth. I shouldn't be a Christian who's offended by discipline. I should not be a Christian who's angered by the fact that God's correcting me or that other people point out flaws in my life. If you are, that comes from an insecurity in you. It comes from the fact that you don't understand the love of God correctly. We should cherish discipline. Now, am I there? Heck no. I'm not there. When God disciplines me, I still get offended. I'm still like, oh man, why are you putting me through this? Haven't I grown enough? You know, I get offended. I do. But I'm definitely a lot better than I was. And I know as He continues to discipline me, as He continues to put me through things in my life, I will get better and better and better if I learn to trust Him more and more, to give my life to Him more and more. All right, let's pray. Dear God, I want to thank You again for these passages, how they help us. Please give us the strength to throw off the sin that entangles us, God, and to understand the weights that are in our lives, God. But more than anything, we want to be Christians that are able to see Your beauty, God, to see Your glory, and to delight in You above all things. We love You and we thank You, and in Your name, amen.